Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thank you for joining us. I just spoke with Elizabeth Perry about her new book, Anyuan, Mining China's Revolutionary Tradition, and that was published in 2012 with the University of California Press. This is a book that looks at the ways that revolutionary projects, revolutionary authority were translated, disseminated, and propagated in the context of 20th century Chinese history, focusing in particular on the significance of Anyuan, which is a coal mining town. In both the period of the emergence of communist revolution in China and then the period in which the early stages of communist revolution were reappropriated, translated, and adapted to in various different ways and different kinds of stories and histories over the course of the remainder of the 20th century and even to today. It's an amazing book, and I'm not being hyperbolic there. There's a really striking way that Liz managed to both create a really carefully developed and very clearly articulated argument throughout the book, while at the same time telling a really wonderful story. The narrative skill and the narrative craft of this book is impeccable. She takes your hand as a reader and leads you through every step of the story that you need to understand in order to really fully grasp the aspects of her argument and how the changes that she is describing and articulating in the book came to be and why they came to be. It's a really wonderful use of sources. It's an extraordinarily compelling story, and it's just a really amazingly impressive book. It was wonderful to talk with Liz about it, and she's just very articulate about the entire book and the process of coming to the topic, and as you'll see in the ensuing conversation, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today to talk with Elizabeth Perry about her new book, Anyuan, Mining China's Revolutionary Tradition. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Liz, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. So could you start us off by saying a little bit about a question that's really, really huge, but please feel free to come at this in whatever way you want. What brought you to the study of China and to the political and social history of modern China, specifically in the first place?
Actually, I think for me, it's a pretty easy answer. I was brought to it because I was born in China. My parents had been teaching for about 20 years at St. John's University in Shanghai. But rather than growing up in China, as I otherwise might have, our family ended up having to leave China only a few months after I was born because of the Chinese Revolution. So I grew up in Japan instead and was always fascinated by the Chinese Revolution, which had caused such a major change in my family's life. So I think my interest in China, in the Chinese Revolution, really came from the circumstances of my birth. But then I was in college at the time of major anti-war protests in this country, and I was very active politically in the anti-war movement against the United States' involvement in Vietnam. And I think, like most people around my age who are in Chinese studies, that fascination with the Chinese Revolution, which came naturally to those who were interested in opposing the war in Vietnam, which many of us saw as opposition to the Vietnamese Revolution, was quite common. So it's both a matter of birth, I think, and then a matter of the political activities that I engaged in as a college student and a graduate student that drew me quite naturally to the study of modern China and the Chinese Revolution in particular.
Now, in the acknowledgments of the book that we're talking about today, you mention a conversation with a colleague over dinner that inspired what eventually became the book and the research process that led into your creating this book and focusing on this topic. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how you came to focus on Anyuan in particular, and perhaps situate this within the larger trajectory of your work more broadly?
I would certainly never have written this book had it not been for my colleague in Beijing, Professor Yu Jianrong of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. As I note in the preface, I had invited Dr. Yu to Harvard because I had read a couple of amazing essays that he had written about present protest in Hunan. He's from Hunan himself, in the late 1990s. He related those peasant protests to the revolutionary tradition of the Hunan peasants. And I was so struck that there was an academic courageous enough to draw these links between contemporary protest and the protest that led to the Chinese Communist Revolution that I invited him here. He gave a riveting talk about contemporary protest in China. And then over dinner afterwards, when we were relaxing, he said to me, "Do you know why I came to Harvard?" And I said jocularly, "Of course I do. I invited you here to give this wonderful talk." And he said, "No, I came because I want to invite you to visit the Anyuan coal mine." He had already been conducting research at Anyuan for about 6 years, I believe. But he told me he hadn't really been able to write a word yet, and he wondered if I would join him in a collaborative project. Initially, I was very reluctant to do that. I was working on another book on militias and the Chinese Revolution, and I told him I just could not contemplate doing anything more. But after he returned to China a few months later, he sent me an email saying that he had already made all the arrangements for my forthcoming visit to Anyuan, and so I felt I couldn't refuse his very generous offer. And when I got to the Anyuan coal mine that summer, I was really struck with how fascinating a place it really was. It had everything that Professor Yu had promised that it would have, both peasants and workers, both leaders and followers, both a very vibrant tradition of pre-communist rural rebellion. And then it was the major center of the communist labor movement for 3 years in the 1920s. So once I got there, I realized that, in fact, Anyuan did fit very centrally into the interests that had motivated so much of my writing throughout my career. I've been equally interested in rural protest and in urban protest, in peasants and in workers, and in pre-communist protest and in the revolution and its consequences. And all of this seemed to be encapsulated there in Anyuan. So thanks to Professor Yu, who accompanied me on several memorable trips together to Anyuan and who helped me secure very valuable documentary and archival resources, and who also explained many issues to me that I found rather opaque, I was able to write this book. But a second Chinese scholar was also particularly helpful to me here, and that was Professor Cai Shaoqing of the Nanjing University History Department. Professor Cai has retired several years ago, but he was my primary mentor in 1979-80 when I spent a year at Nanjing University as part of the first academic exchange between the U.S. and China. I spent a year at Nanda working on the Taiping revolutionary or rebellious movement, depending on how you categorize it, and the relationship between the Taipings and secret societies. And during that year, Professor Cai, on a number of occasions, related to me his trips to Anyuan in the late 1950s when he had gone there to interview miners about their revolutionary tradition. And Professor Cai had also interviewed the early leader of the Communist Party, Li Lisan, back in Beijing and talked to him about his own experiences at Anyuan. And so as I was at Anyuan, these conversations with Professor Cai of several decades earlier began to flood back into my memory. And it was a great pleasure together with Professor Yu to go to Nanjing to introduce the two of them to each other, and with Professor Yu to be able to ask Professor Cai for his perspective perspective, which dated back to Anyuan in the 1950s. So in many ways, this book reflects the wonderful opportunities that we all have now to collaborate with Chinese scholars, something that was, of course, unavailable when I first entered the China field.
And there's actually, for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, there's a really wonderful description and account and analysis in one of the last chapters of the book of Professor Yu's own work on Anyuan, and in particular on workers, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, in Anyuan. And it's really, it's one of the really wonderful things about the last part of the book is the way that you're opening us up to contemporary strands of Chinese scholarship on the same topics.
Yes, Professor Yu did write his own book on Anyuan, on the workers of Anyuan, using them as a kind of symbol for the plight of the contemporary Chinese working class. His book is a magnificent book, quite different from my own. It doesn't have the same kind of historical emphasis that mine does. His is much more contemporary, ethnographic, and has much more in the way of color of the way in which contemporary workers in Anyuan speak about their own experiences. He did very detailed and very lively interviews with a range of ordinary miners, local cadres, and so on in Anyuan, and in their own words, allows them to speak about how they see the contemporary situation. Professor Yu's book has been published only in Hong Kong. It was to have been published in the PRC in a simplified character version, but then the Department of Propaganda pulled the plug on that just before the book was to be sold in the PRC. So although it's very well known by PRC scholars who have access often to the Hong Kong edition or to snippets of it over the internet, it is not permitted, very unfortunately, within mainland China.
Now, as we move into the body of the book, you frame in the introduction a set of questions that are going to motivate what comes later. And these questions are ones that you lay out for us, I think, really clearly at the beginning. These include, what explains the very particular trajectory of Chinese communist revolutionary effort? How and why did Chinese patterns diverge so dramatically from Russian ones on which they were based? And what meanings does the revolutionary tradition hold for Chinese citizens today? And to those, I'd add also, how can we situate these questions within Anyuan as a place and within its local, national, and global histories? And one of the things that comes out of this history, I think, so trenchantly and so really beautifully is an attention to different modes of historiography and different ways that these same events have been historicized and told and retold by various different groups to serve various different purposes. So it's a really, really nice account of sort of comparative historiography in a way, in addition to the larger historical account that it's telling itself. Now, in starting to answer these questions, we see a number of factors playing major roles here, and this brings me to a question I'll ask you in a moment. How did the communists get ordinary Chinese is one of the sort of major questions here to understand, to accept, and even embrace the authority of the revolution, to embrace revolutionary authority. And your argument that's going to structure the book and thread through the entire book is going to hinge on the importance of what you call the strategic deployment of a range of symbolic and cultural resources for the purpose of political persuasion. And these include religious, ritual, rhetoric, dress-related, drama, artistic, et cetera, kinds of cultural resources. Can you speak a little bit to how you came to focus on sort of cultural resources and these kinds of symbolic resources in particular as the really the way into starting to answer these major questions? And for you, how are you thinking of culture in the context of this book as a concept, as a motivating sort of structure?
Well, when I began this research, that was not at all the framework that I had in mind. When Professor Yu approached me about doing some collaborative research, he said he had read my earlier work on the Shanghai labor movement, which is much more a work of political economy than this An Yuan book. And he had been trying to fit the An Yuan story into the framework that I had developed in my Shanghai book, and it didn't quite fit for him, and so he wanted me to kind of squeeze it into that framework for him. And I told him there was probably a reason that it didn't fit, that An Yuan and Shanghai were in fact quite different places, and that maybe we needed a rather different approach to understanding the situation in An Yuan. And I also told him the only thing I could really remember about An Yuan at that point, when I first engaged in this work, was the very famous oil painting of Chairman Mao going to An Yuan that was painted during the Cultural Revolution by a young Red Guard artist, and that I knew had been a kind of central prop in the Mao cult of the Cultural Revolution and its immediate aftermath. And so always in my mind when I went to An Yuan was, on the one hand, this very famous painting of it, but on the other hand, a sense that, you know, perhaps the framework that I had used for understanding the Shanghai labor movement wouldn't be the most appropriate one for making sense of this story. But I certainly didn't begin with a determination to have a kind of cultural framework for understanding what had happened at An Yuan. It was really, as I read more and more about what the young communists had done there in order to mobilize workers, and in particular what the young Li Lisan had done at An Yuan, that it became increasingly clear to me that an emphasis on the use of cultural materials, both elite cultural materials and popular cultural materials, excuse me, was critical to Li Lisan's success. Li Lisan came from just across the border from An Yuan, from a county in Hunan. He was intimately familiar with the folk practices as well as the elite conventions of that area. His own father was a Confucian degree holder and a school teacher. And his own father made connections for Li Lisan with the elite in An Yuan, so that when Li Lisan went there, he had a personal introduction to the magistrate and the head of the Chamber of Commerce. And he used his own training in classical Chinese to write in lovely calligraphy and in fluid literary Chinese a petition seeking the support of the magistrate for his plan to open a school to educate the workers. I then, as I read more about what Li Lisan did, realized how inventive he was in using not only this kind of elite Mandarin culture, and he and Mao also, it might be noted, wore their long scholar's gowns when they first arrived at An Yuan, making clear to the workers that they were educated intellectuals and deserving of that kind of respect. But Li Lisan also very quickly got to know the members of the so-called Red Gang, the Hongbang, a branch of the Triad Secret Society that was active there at An Yuan. He recruited Triad members to his new movement. He learned from them the code words of the Red Gang Secret Society, and he enlisted the support of the Red Gang chieftain in that area for the strike before he called it. When Li Lisan was recruiting workers to his new so-called labor, well, it was really a trade union, a labor union, but it was a so-called worker recreation club. He used that euphemistic title. But he did so using many of the conventions of folk festivals and folk religion in that area. So he paraded a palanquin through the streets of An Yuan, much as was used in temple festivals. But on this particular occasion, he put inside the palanquin not a statue of local temple gods, local deities, as was the norm. Instead, he put in there a statue of Karl Marx, which you can see if you go to the An Yuan Museum. That little bronze bust of Marx is still on display there. So he did a number of things that took advantage of his understanding of the connection between culture and power, if you will, that was very creative. And the more I read about his activities, the more I realized that this really had to be a central part of the story. It was something I didn't feel entirely comfortable with at first because, as I say, my own work for the most part has been more oriented toward ecological issues, issues of political economy and so forth. And this was more of an excursion into the symbolic and the cultural than I had previously dared to conduct.
Now, Lili-san is someone who is very important to this story in many ways, both for his visibility in parts of the book and also for later on his invisibility in parts of the story. And so we'll definitely be talking more about him. Now, the book itself, as we move further into it, it's structurally set up in what we can consider to be two parts. The first four chapters look at and explore the role of this cultural positioning that we've been talking about in revolutionary mobilization in Anyuan. The last three chapters really look at the power of cultural patronage as different groups in different places and for different reasons appropriated, translated, reinterpreted this complex heritage and history of Anyuan. Now, there's as much, this is really a striking way to approach the book. There's as much attention paid here to the recovery and reinvention of this Anyuan tradition as there is to the initial revolutionary period itself. So can you say a bit about that decision? How did you come to decide to approach it this way, both narratively and structurally?
Well, I guess the explanation for that two-part structure is, in part, I was very interested in trying to figure out what had actually happened at Anyuan, because having known very little about the place initially, except for that famous oil painting, I wanted to figure out what the history was behind that religious icon of the Cultural Revolution. So that sent me back to, I knew that during the Cultural Revolution, this Anyuan painting had been used as criticism of Liu Shaoqi, that there had been criticism of vice chairman of the Communist Party, Mao's rival, if you will, but his number two person, that there had been criticism of Liu for his activities at Anyuan, and that this painting had played a role in that. And so I wanted to figure out what the true story was behind that, what Mao had actually done at Anyuan, what Liu Shaoqi had actually done at Anyuan. I didn't initially, except for the stories I had heard from Professor Tsai in Nanjing, know very much at all about Lili-san's involvement in Anyuan. But I figured I first needed to try to piece together as best I could what seemed to me to be a plausible and honest history of the early communist movement at Anyuan. And once I had done that, that I would be in a much better position to evaluate why this oil painting had been done, why it had been so important in the Cultural Revolution, why everybody who had been of Red Guard age was immediately familiar with this image and knew that it was a cultural representation of Mao's attack on Liu Shaoqi. So those were the kinds of things that made me from the outset realize that I wanted this to be a book that had a long historical sweep. Actually, most of my work has been of this sort. Most of the books I've written begin in the late imperial period and go at least to the beginnings of the communist period, but increasingly right down to the present, since I think as I look at these topics more and more, the continuities from earlier times down to the present strike me as more and more significant and more worth pursuing. But one of the things that I ended up concluding from this study, which I really hadn't anticipated from the beginning, was the extent to which all this manipulation, if you will, of history and so on has actually redounded to the benefit, I think, of the resilience of Chinese communism. initially I had thought that, well, looking at the Onion story will just expose how much deception and manipulation and so forth there was once cultural positioning was supplanted by cultural patronage. And to some extent, that's a major theme in this book. But also important, I have felt, is that over time, as the Chinese Communist Party, as the Central Department of Propaganda, has had more and more experience in its activities, that the reworking of historical material by the propaganda department has helped to turn what really was, in many respects, an alien revolution that was imported from the Soviet Union, that ideologically and organizationally was very unfamiliar to China, has helped to make that tradition somehow feel as though it was distinctively Chinese. And what studying Anyuan helped me appreciate was how much, on the one hand, had actually been copied from the Soviet Union. Anyuan was known from 1922 to 1925 as China's little Moscow. It was the place where all kinds of things, from the architecture of the Bolshoi Grand Theater to the organization of a kind of Soviet-style regime, were copied directly from the Soviet Union. Liu Shaoqi, who was at that time in charge of Anyuan, had had a long period of study in the Soviet Union and was trying to implement those ideas within China. So on the one hand, objectively, both the ideology and the institutions were very Soviet. And yet, from the beginning of the revolution, there was among those leaders who were very clever and who understood what is involved in mobilizing people and in capturing their emotional attention, there was a recognition that these very new things had to be presented in a way that made them feel, smell, taste Chinese. Li Lisan, I think, was a master of that. Mao was pretty good at that himself. Liu Shaoqi, I think, was much less skilled at it, but still was doing his best. And right down to the present, we see this in the activities of the Chinese propaganda department and the way in which it put on an international Olympics, or the way in which it sells its Confucius Institutes abroad, such that in China today, I think most people think of their revolution as being really very Chinese. It has, its revolutionary tradition has all kinds of problems. They'll be happy to acknowledge that there is a kind of what they call emperor worship in the way in which the system is structured, that there is nepotism, there is corruption, and so on. But these things are thought of as very Chinese rather than an alien Soviet system that was somehow implanted and imposed on China. And I think the result of that has been that the Chinese Communist Party is able to present itself as a nationalist institution to its own people, in a way, ironically, perhaps, that in the Soviet Union, their own Communist Party could not so easily do, since the Soviet Union was an amalgam of all sorts of different nationalities, and it was very difficult to present their Communist Party as, on the one hand, Russian and on the other hand, Soviet. In China, this has been somewhat less problematic, since although there are plenty of national minorities in China, they're a much smaller percentage of the population. But the real credit for this, I think, goes not to the demographic distribution of China, but to the capabilities of a number of communist leaders in China from the very beginning of the party down to the present. We saw this in Deng Xiaoping's decision to talk about the reforms in China as a Chinese type of socialism, socialism with Chinese characteristics. Deng Xiaoping's decision not to overtly deny the Maoist heritage or the revolution, but instead to embrace it as another example of the unification and the strengthening of China, and then to move away from much of that revolutionary tradition, but yet to present it as though it's connected with it. These, I think, are really very skillful acts on the part of the Chinese communist leadership. And although they're introducing ideas and institutions that in many ways are foreign, are Western, are Soviet, are alien, they've done so in a way that understands the importance of cultural power, and understanding that is, of course, central to Chinese notions of political control, and has been for a very long period of time.
Now, one of the things that the early part of the book demonstrates really well is the way in which early and young communist leaders were able to take advantage of and mobilize potential vehicles for mobilizing for their own purposes that already existed in some form in this region, in Anyuan in particular. So after you've already said a little bit about Anyuan as a place, kind of what made it so important for the purpose of this study. You've also mentioned local secret societies and that the kind of triad groups, the Elder Brother Society being the one that's really very important in this first part of the book. They become the main, well, most of the Anyuan miners belong to this Elder Brother Society, and the society becomes the main instigator of rebellion and collective violence in the region. Now, what happens is young Chinese intellectuals are able to take that as raw material and transform that into a vehicle for shaping society in their own ways and for redirecting that energy and redirecting their that violence to different or in different kinds of ways. You describe that one of the ways that made these efforts so successful was an emphasis on the special status of literati and their activities in Chinese society, the emphasis on perhaps the Wen part of the Wen Wu dyad. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that recurs at several points along this story.
Yes. We don't have too many cultural explanations, if you will, of the Chinese Revolution. When we do, those explanations a la Lucian Pai or Dick Solomon tend to suggest that there was something, a kind of authoritarianism, if you will, built into Chinese traditional culture that helped to facilitate communist authoritarianism. And then part of the reason that we don't have too many cultural explanations is that most people, for good reason, have seen the communists as quite hostile to traditional Chinese culture, since actually official communist policy was to deny so-called feudal superstition and feudal remnants, to deny the validity of folk religion, folk culture, and so forth. So that although it was used instrumentally, it was not officially endorsed. But there have been a few treatments of Mao's own interest in folk culture, in the rebellious tradition of the Taipings and so on. But there has been very little serious attention, I think, to the way in which the early communist leaders were able to use the fact that almost all of them were very well-educated intellectuals who commanded a great deal of respect among ordinary people precisely because of their literati status. And so I think it is no accident that Mao, when he first went to Anyuan, went as a school teacher. Of course, that wasn't a guise. He was, in fact, a school teacher in Changsha at the time, so it was quite normal for him to be wearing his Mandarin gown when he first appeared at Anyuan. The same with Li Lisan, who had been educated in the Confucian tradition and taught for a few years as a school teacher in his home county of Liling before he went off to France for higher education. And these individuals, I think, understood that the Confucian teacher commanded a great deal of respect among ordinary people in Chinese society, most of whom had a tremendous thirst for education themselves and a great admiration and respect for literary education. So the ability of these early communist cadres to use that literati tradition, both to present themselves as less than threatening to the local elite and thereby gain some space from the local elite for their activities, and also to convince local people that they were in a kind of benevolent position, trying to help them, trying to share this wonderful literacy with them, gave them an entree that I think was really very special. And although in the Soviet Union, you also have this early mobilizing strategy of setting up schools for workers, the Bolsheviks also were interested in doing that. The readings I have done, which are not complete by any means, but the readings I have done on the Russian Revolution suggest to me that that same strategy was far less successful in Russia than was true in China, in part because in Russia, as I understand it, at least, there was just not the same thirst for literacy or respect for the intelligentsia or the local school teacher that there was in rural China. I think the communists understood this and they took advantage of it. But I don't mean for that to sound simply instrumental or callous or conniving on their part. They were obviously anxious to provide education to the workers and to the peasants so that they could be politicized, so that they could engage in this revolution and what they thought was going to win them a better life. So I certainly don't mean to suggest that this deployment of Confucian as well as folk culture was simply calculated and was not something that in many respects was quite natural or second nature or even subconscious to these leaders. I think it was a combination of conscious deliberation and a subconscious engagement, involvement in both elite and popular culture from their local area that allowed them to do this. It was no coincidence, I think, that Lili San came, as I said, from right across the border from Anyuan. Mao came from just a bit further away in Hunan, in Xiangtan, from which also many of the coal miners came. Liu Shaoqi came from further away in Hunan, and actually very few of the miners came from the county where Liu Shaoqi hailed from, and that may, along with their very different personalities, also help to explain why Lili San seemed to be so particularly gifted at communicating with the local miners. Mao, maybe a little bit less so, but also very impressively so, and Liu Shaoqi perhaps somewhat less so than the other two.
Now, in September 1922, Mao Zedong, Liu Shaoqi, and Lili San organized together the launching of a successful nonviolent strike at Anyuan that became one of the early milestones of the Chinese Communist Revolution. After successfully concluding the strike, and again, I think you described this as a five-day-long strike of 13,000 miners and railway workers that resulted in a victory without property damage, without personal injury, and this became a real milestone here. After that strike is successfully concluded, Anyuan becomes a national center for communist organizing for the next 3 years, and we see here a change in leadership, and we see the emergence of a very different model of leadership in Liu Shaoqi. You've already alluded to this, but can you talk a little bit about this, about Liu Shaoqi's model in particular, and in particular his approach toward some of the ways of making the Anyuan Workers' Club into this educational and sort of cultural vehicle and set of technologies that become so important to what happens later on?
Yes, Liu Shaoqi, as you mentioned, was in charge of Anyuan for the better part of 3 years right after the strike. He was sent by Mao to Anyuan just a couple of days before the strike was called, in part because Mao feared that Lili San's very freewheeling, charismatic, colorful mode of mobilizing the workers, successful as it had been in winning both the elite and the mining force to his side, could prove to be a real liability in the time of a strike when it was very important to maintain, to keep a lid on the potential for violence. As you mentioned, this was an area where secret societies, the Elder Brothers Society, the Red Gang Triads, were largely in command. And Mao, in particular, was very worried for the potential that these gangsters, if you will, would explode in violence once the strike was called. And so Mao sent Liu Shaoqi, who already had a reputation, having just returned from the Soviet Union, a reputation for being a highly disciplined Leninist-style cadre, sent him to Anyuan to kind of ride herd over Li Lishan and make sure that this strike was well-disciplined, well-controlled. And the strike was, as you mentioned, conducted with no bloodshed, with virtually zero property damage, and yet one major gains for the workers after only 5 days off the job. The entire workforce of some 13,000 workers, this was part of the largest industrial complex in China at the time, the Han Yeping Company. So really quite a phenomenal achievement to have all these workers out on strike. And they did so without violence. Shortly after the conclusion of the strike, Li Lishan was sent off to Wuhan and then from there to Shanghai to carry the lessons that he had learned, the techniques that he had pioneered at Anyuan to these other Chinese industrial centers. And Liu Shaoqi remained at Anyuan as the person in charge of the workers' club. While there, he presided over a workers' club that became a hub of cultural activities for the Chinese labor movement. At that workers' club, new style dramas, operas, films, all kinds of things were initiated, experimented with, taken from Anyuan out into the countryside and performed before peasants and villages in order to mobilize them to the communist movement. Seven schools controlled by the communists to educate workers and their children were opened up in the greater Anyuan area. This workers' club, which had first been founded by Li Lishan, was rebuilt in a style that Liu Shaoqi claimed replicated the Bolshoi Grand Theater in Moscow, although to me, having spent a lot of time in it and looking at it, it looks far more Chinese than it does Russian. But in any case, in Liu Shaoqi's mind, what he was trying to do was to replicate at Anyuan much of what he saw as the successful recipe of agitation propaganda that Lenin had advocated in the Russian Revolution and had been developed in the early Soviet Union. But it had very much a Chinese twist to it. In particular, there were costume lectures for which I found no direct parallel in the Russian tradition, but seem to have been very much influenced by Chinese traditions of local opera. This area of Jiangxi is famous for a kind of, it's called tea picking, cha cai xi, that tea picking opera that was also used as the kind of formula for a number of new dramas, new operas with a revolutionary content. So during these 3 years, Anyuan became a hub for this cultural experimentation, which was then taken from Anyuan to the Jiangxi Soviet in the early 1930s as the center of the communist movement moved east across Jiangxi province and then was taken with the communists in their famous Red Theater as they moved up to Yan'an and to the various base areas during the wartime period. So these cultural experimentations were very important, but it's quite striking when you look at the interviews of workers that were done after this period. The workers who knew both Li Lishan and Liu Shaoqi remember Lili-san so much more warmly, so much more fondly, because he obviously, his personality, his close knowledge of the area, viewed as a kind of local son, his personal warmth, his willingness to kind of set precedent and tradition aside, to get very close to the workers, all of that came through in a way that Liu Shaoqi's more disciplined, more Leninist kind of approach did not. So Liu Shaoqi, on the one hand, was really quite successful in presiding over Anyuan in this critical period when much of the Chinese labor movement elsewhere in China was being closed down, was being suppressed by warlord opposition. But at the other, on the other hand, he doesn't seem to have elicited the same kind of warm response from the workers that his predecessor Lili-san did. And so Liu Shaoqi is a kind of interesting sort of intermediate figure here, who's very anxious to introduce Soviet ways into China. In many ways, in his essays, he talks about how unhappy he is that he has to actually compromise these Soviet precedents in order to really make them suitable for the Chinese situation, in a way that Lili-san seemed to have celebrated, Liu Shaoqi seems to apologize for, but Liu Shaoqi is there also translating these Russian ideas into a form of cultural activity that will seem familiar and appealing to the workers.
Thank you so much. Now, as we move into the latter part of the book, we see the workers' club and the associated movement eventually being attacked and not recovering. And this is connected, as you show, especially in the fourth chapter, to a transformation of the communist revolution in China from a proletarian to a peasant movement. Concomitant with this transformation is also a movement from what had been, as we sort of talked about in the context of the strike, a movement that was largely characterized by discipline, by restraint, into a much more violent situation. And you talk in this chapter about the emergence of the Red Terror, the escalation of violence feeding into a wider militarization of the countryside and the birth of the Red Army. And again, NUN remains really central to this because a lot of the former NUN workers became propagandists and became leaders in this context of the Red Army, for which cultural propaganda, as you're showing here, is such a central technology and is such a central medium. Now, as we move past this into what happens later, we see the emergence of, and we've sort of alluded to this before, Liu Shaoqi being elevated into a revolutionary leader. And so even though we've been focusing a little bit on how important Lili-san was, Liu Shaoqi actually gets built up as a leader and then gets taken back down again. Can you talk a little bit about this? Because this leads us into the second half of this book, where we see the story of Anyuan as a revolutionary center being taken up in very different ways over time, and in that process, very different leaders emerging as figureheads and cultural figureheads in particular for that period.
Yes, that's right. After the establishment of the PRC in the fall of 1949, Mao was chair of the Chinese Communist Party, and Liu Shaoqi was vice chair of the party. Liu Shaoqi at that time was being groomed as Mao's successor, and this became even more the case in the late 1950s, early 1960s, in the aftermath of the terrible famine occasioned by the Great Leap Forward. Mao stepped back from the front line of policymaking. Liu Shaoqi became the more, well, at least the more public leader in that period as he was being groomed to be Mao's successor. As part of that effort to build up the leadership credentials of Liu Shaoqi, there was a major propaganda campaign, if you will, to burnish Liu Shaoqi's credentials as a proletarian leader. And in this period, then, the history of Anyuan became very important as the political capital of Liu Shaoqi, showing that he had been a major leader of the labor movement of the proletariat from the early 1920s on. The implication then was that Mao was the leader of the peasant movement. Of course, the peasant was the major social basis of the Chinese Communist Revolution, but nevertheless, the proletariat really, in Marx's theory, is the vanguard and is a more advanced political class than the peasantry. And so Liu Shaoqi, by showing himself to have been the leader of the proletariat with a major oil painting showing his activities at Anyuan completed in the early 1960s and put in the new Museum of the Revolution, with a sort of novelistic, part fictional, part factual account of Liu Shaoqi's activities at Anyuan called Red Anyuan, published around this same time. The essays that Liu Shaoqi had written while at Anyuan, republished, but also republished with some crucial phrases that now seemed a little embarrassing to him, excised from those materials, with new dramas, operas, and so on produced, and a new movie produced that showed Liu Shaoqi as the hero of Anyuan. All of this was an effort to promote Liu Shaoqi at the expense of Li Lisan. In fact, many of the things for which Li Lisan deserved full credit, organizing the strike, coming up with the slogan for the strike, being the first to set up a school for workers at Anyuan, being the first to organize a labor movement at Anyuan, and so on, all of those things now were credited to Liu Shaoqi. So there was a propaganda blitz in the late 50s, early 60s to build up the image of Liu Shaoqi, and the history of Anyuan was central to that effort. This was a period in which Li Lisan was under a cloud. Li Lisan had been banished to the Soviet Union for about 15 years before the establishment of the PRC. He had been brought back to China from the Soviet Union just before the communists successfully established the People's Republic, because at that earlier period, it had been recognized that Li Lisan was, in fact, the leader who was best equipped to handle the workers. This was a communist party that was now marching out of the countryside and into occupied cities, and they realized they needed cadres with expertise in the industrial workforce. And so Li Lisan was brought back from the Soviet Union at that period of time. He was made the first Minister of Labor and the effective head of the trade union in the early PRC. But when Li Lisan, just as he had at Anyuan and Wuhan and Shanghai, began to advocate in the early PRC for workers' rights, he was then criticized by the leadership, including Liu Shaoqi himself, for having been economistic, syndicalistic, for having promoted workers' rights at the expense of Leninist party control. And so Li Lisan was relieved of his posts, both with the trade union and with the labor ministry, and basically was under a cloud from 1951, well, even 1950, but certainly 51 and then into 52 on, allowing space for the supporters of Liu Shaoqi to rewrite the history of Anyuan in a way that almost entirely erased Li Lisan's contributions and gave Liu Shaoqi credit for everything, including credit for things that Mao Zedong himself had done at Anyuan, which then became a point of contention during the Cultural Revolution when Liu Shaoqi was criticized and the propaganda department then turned its cult of personality toward Mao Zedong in a way that dwarfed what had been done for Liu Shaoqi a few years earlier.
And this actually, this period, this actually brings us into the very last part of the book, and this period in which you're describing the dethroning of Liu Shaoqi and the replacement by Mao, or the replacement of Mao as the figurehead with the rise of the Red Guards, leads us into just one phenomenon here that I can't let you go without asking you about. So before we conclude, it's the way that the last two chapters of the book, as you lead us into this story of the replacement of Liu, the emergence of Mao, and then the everything changing again as Mao's position as the unambiguous leader is later on also taken over by a different picture of the historiography of this period of revolution. Central to these phenomena, as you show here, are images, are paintings, are also architectural spaces as spaces of historiography and of history making. You've mentioned already very early on in our conversation this painting, Chairman Mao Goes to Anyuan, by Liu Chunhua, who was a Red Guard. And this this part of your story is a really wonderful place where we see a kind of history being made through the circulation, appropriation, and translation of images. So can you speak a little bit, before we conclude, to that aspect of the story in this last part of the book, the importance of paintings, of images, of exhibition spaces as spaces for the retelling and the creation of different modes of history?
Yes, you know, I think these practices of these kinds of revolutionary images and museum spaces, exhibition spaces, how they were set up and what messages they were trying to convey and so on, actually came very much out of a Soviet style of propaganda, but were conducted in such a way that, again, they made this revolution feel more Chinese. So the image of Mao that we see in this painting, Chairman Mao Goes to Anyuan, is the image of Mao in his long scholar's gown, holding an oiled paper umbrella that in the Chinese accounts of this painting is supposedly a Hunan made umbrella. So Mao is coming from his native place of Hunan, striding into Anyuan. The image of a young Chinese intellectual coming to sow the seeds of revolution among the proletariat. The imagery, it's really quite interesting. Interviews that were conducted by American art historians with the painter Liu Chunhua suggest that the inspiration for this painting came in part from German Romanticism. In part, he suggests that it came from the paintings of Raphael, Italian Renaissance religious paintings of the Transfiguration of Christ and the Madonna and so forth. So these are very Western-inspired notions of art, which also were some of the Western traditions that inspired Soviet propaganda art, and yet being portrayed in a way that makes this somehow feel quite Chinese. And so I do think these exhibition spaces, the building of new museums, it happens that this new Anyuan Museum that was built in 1968 during the height of the Cultural Revolution and originally was named the Memorial Hall to Honor Chairman Mao's Revolutionary Activities in Anyuan, was built right in the space where a church, an Episcopal church, had been before the revolution. The symbolism of a kind of new church, if you will, to Chairman Mao and to his revolution, replacing that old religious space and towering above the Anyuan Workers Club that Liu Shaoqi had renovated, located just below this massive hill on which the new museum was built. These kinds of images, I think, and spatial representations are very powerful in the local area for signaling to people that there are new gods occupying these temples. And it's quite interesting the way in which locals refer to these in religious terms, talk about Liu Shaoqi's temple being replaced by Chairman Mao's temple, and pilgrims going to burn incense at the new temple to Chairman Mao rather than the old one to Liu Shaoqi. So on the one hand, these have a very strong Western kind of origin, but on the other hand, they're saying to the locals, oh, there's a new god in town, there's a new power, because these spaces that traditionally were occupied by different religious traditions are now being occupied by a kind of communist religious tradition. So I think the iconography was very important to allowing people to see politics in a way that imbued it with a kind of sacred or religious authority. I think that was true in the case of the Soviet Union as well. Scholars of Soviet propaganda talk about how images of Stalin were very much built on Western religious art, how powerful the traditions of the Catholic Church were in influencing Soviet modes of agitation propaganda. And that, I think, becomes very important for the Chinese transmogrification of this, although in a way that becomes interpreted quite differently from the Soviet or Russian case.
Well, Liz, thank you so much. We've taken up a lot of your time, and I don't want to take up too much more, but I do want to give you a chance as we come to a conclusion. If there's anything else about the book that we didn't cover, but that you'd like to point out, especially for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read it, to say something about that. And I'll say this for listeners, or I'll signal to listeners that it's an extraordinarily rich book, and we didn't get to probably even 25% of the really fascinating stuff that comes up in all of these chapters. But is there anything in particular you'd like to mention?
Well, first of all, thank you for your very generous remarks about the book. There is one thing, I guess, that I would mention in conclusion, and that is that much of what concerned me as I was writing the book was this question of what is a revolutionary tradition really for? Of course, we here in the United States also have a country that was born in revolution and in which the revolutionary tradition remains politically very salient. Witness the Tea Party movement in recent years with its name derived, of course, from the famous incident in Boston Harbor that helped to ignite the American Revolution, and harking back to certain principles of the American Revolution, no taxation without representation, and so forth. Not too long ago, I had the opportunity to make a trip to Cuba. I was struck there with how much people there in Cuba also talked about their revolutionary tradition. When I asked them what their revolutionary tradition meant to them, I was very struck with the fact that almost everyone gave me virtually the same answer. They said their revolutionary tradition meant universal education and universal welfare, universal medical care. Here in the United States, I think if you ask almost everyone, we'll give you a pretty similar answer. Our revolution means political freedom. It means the right to believe what we want religiously and politically. It means the right to free speech. It means the right to individual liberties. But I'm equally struck when I ask this same question in China. Nobody can tell me what their revolutionary tradition means. Generally, although this term, Geming Chuantong, is used constantly in communist propaganda, you know, people will shake their heads, smile, or give me a sarcastic kind of answer, but hardly anyone. To the extent that people try to give an answer, they'll usually say, oh, our revolutionary tradition is violence. It's all about class struggle. That's our revolutionary tradition, and we need to forget it. But I think no country that actually is born in revolution can entirely forget their revolutionary tradition. And China, I believe, is no exception to that. And part of thinking through the An Yuan story to me was, again, an occasion to think about how very, very complicated any revolutionary tradition is. It, by definition, involves violence and bloodshed that has to be pacified in some way in order to have political stability afterwards. But on the other hand, that revolution was motivated by certain ideals, certain principles that also probably need to be remembered and clarified, unless one is going to have unfortunate repetition of some of the least desirable and most violent aspects of that tradition. The Chinese Revolution is particularly complicated because it stretches back to the 1911 revolution. It's full of bloodshed and violence. It has both urban and rural wings to it. Class struggle, of course, does become a central part of the Communist Revolution and the Cultural Revolution that followed it. But I also felt, going back to the An Yuan story, that there were some very important ideals to that revolution that involved dignity for the downtrodden, that really was the message with which Li Lishan mobilized miners in the 1920s. It was that idea that these people were human, that they were not beasts of burden. They were not cattle and horses. They were ren. They were people, and they had human dignity. And that's why they deserve to learn how to read and write. That's why they deserve to learn how to stand up and make a political speech. That's why they deserved a revolution that would give them new opportunities. That sense of a revolutionary tradition, I think, has been somewhat lost and obfuscated by all of these historiographic changes that you referred to. And so my hope was not that I would be the one to tell Chinese what their revolutionary tradition ought to consist of. Obviously, Chinese need to do that, but at least to draw some attention to these multiple readings of revolutionary traditions in any particular country, and to bring attention to the importance of recovering a tradition in a way that allows people to move forward toward a politics that is worthy of all the sacrifices that people paid in the violence and bloodshed of this revolutionary period. So I think I would just end with those remarks. I wrote this book, I must say, with a kind of Chinese as well as an American readership in mind. It is being translated into Chinese, and I don't know in what form it will be allowed to circulate in the PRC. If anything, it's that much more sensitive than Professor Yu Jianrong's wonderful book on An Yuan. But I did write it hoping to stimulate a conversation on the part of Chinese and Americans alike as we think about our revolutionary past and how we want to deal with that past going forward.
Well, thank you so much, Liz. And now that this book is out, my final question for you is, what's next for you? Are there any projects right now that are currently inspiring you?
Well, I'm engaged in a couple of projects, one of which does come very much out of this An Yuan book, and that is a study of what I call cultural governance in the PRC, the way in which the Department of Propaganda and the Ministry of Culture have used a whole variety of tools in order to make Chinese communism feel particularly Chinese. So that's one project that's going forward. The other one that's actually quite different from this, but I guess in some respects has some connections as well, is a study, kind of comparative study of higher education in China and different models of higher education, looking first at the Republican period and I've been focusing especially on a couple of very influential American universities in China in the Republican period, St. John's University, where my own parents taught, and Yanjing University, with which the Harvard Yanjing Institute that I currently direct was very closely associated. Studying them as models of very different kinds of global education in the early 20th century and trying to connect that up to the experiments in global education that we see going on in contemporary China, as China is putting huge resources and manpower into trying to rethink its educational system and figure out how it can have an education for the 21st century that nevertheless will be an education that the party hopes, of course, won't rock the boat too seriously. So those are the two areas in which I'm currently working, both of which have some connection, certainly, to this earlier work, but I hope will take me in somewhat new directions as well.
Well, that sounds great. And best of luck with those projects. And thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.